So now the plan for the rest is to talk about the two diagnostics that I mentioned, which are the effective potential for the boundary deformation operator, so in this case alpha or a phi squared. And we can compute this effective potential in both the strongly coupled case corresponding to these Zinsenton geometries and also the free scalar and a sitter. And then next we'll compute a boundary two-point function using a geodesic method. And we'll compare this two-point function and see that the signatures of the singularity, where you start to see some instability, correspond to the massless minimally coupled limit of the free scalar. So for both of these cases, we'll be sort of comparing to the free theory on the boundary just for help interpretation. So now I just want to quote some textbook results for free scalars on three-dimensional de Sitter space. So first, a scalar and de Sitter does not break de Sitter symmetry, so the two-point function and all the correlators can only depend on the de Sitter invariant distance. So the de Sitter invariant distance z can be defined as the invariant element in the embedding space. So here, this capital X is the higher dimensional Minkowski space, where you can define de Sitter as a hyperbola. And the de Sitter invariant distance d is related to the geodesic distance between two points in de Sitter space by this relationship. So when the two points are very close together, the geodesic distance goes to 0, but the de Sitter invariant distance goes to 1. The horizon is in these coordinates located at a geodesic distance of pi, so sort of the antipodal point on the Euclidean sphere. So the horizon is at a de Sitter invariant distance of -1. And as the two points diverge in the super horizon limit, the de Sitter invariant distance goes to -infinity. Okay. So the two-point function or the Green's function for a scalar field on de Sitter can be just written down in terms of hypergeometric functions, but in three dimensions, it simplifies nicely to this expression, which I've plotted here. And so at z equals 1, everything diverges in the same universal light cone singularity. And you can see that as I approach the critical beta in the free theory, which is -3/8, this sign blows up. So independent of distance, I have a diverging factor in my two-point function, and this is just the divergent zero mode that you expect in the massless minimally coupled case. And here, this you can also see the IR tail, so this beta of -0.37 is approaching -3/8, and this correlator stops dying off in the infrared. Okay. So we'll also be interested in the one-point function of this massive this mass operator that we're deforming the theory with. And it can just be taken, you can just get this by taking the coincident limit of this two-point function and subtracting the universal divergence. So by this, I just mean the Green's function in the undeformed conformally coupled case, which only consists of this term that diverges at the short distance. So despite the fact that we're in a free theory, this one-point function is non-zero, and it has dependence on beta that I've put here. And you can see some hint of instability, I guess, is that as you go to the critical deformation of the massless theory, you have a diverging expectation value for this phi-squared operator. Okay. Good. And this, I just wanted to note, matches what these authors computed with a full generating functional for a scalar on a sphere. Okay. So now, this one-point function in the free theory should be compared to the asymptotic data that I get from the instanton solutions in the strongly coupled case. And you can see that both strong and weak coupling, I have a critical deformation beta where the one-point function of this operator diverges. However, the strong coupling case is slightly more interesting in that we have this this minimum appearing, and two values of alpha corresponding to a single beta. Okay. So now we're ready to compute the effective potential for this one-point operator. The effective potential can be got from the quantum effective action. So if you just open up a textbook on quantum field theory, you see a definition of a quantum effective action, gamma, which in the undeformed case, in our notation, is defined via this relationship. So here, for this beta sub I, you should think of the source of the boundary deformation being the being our fixed beta from the instanton geometry. However, we're not interested in giving a source to an undeformed boundary theory, but we want to set these von Neumann boundary conditions. So this results in a shift of the quantum effective action. So here, by this beta BC, I mean the constant beta boundary conditions that we want to enforce, giving rise to this quantum effective action, which is then proportional with the volume of the spacetime to the quantum effective potential for our operator alpha. Okay, so we find this. So this matches the standard quantum effective potential, but it was first used in the way I'll use it in holography, using bulk data to compute this in a paper by Hertog and Horvitz, where they were actually studying soliton solutions in ADS. And you can immediately see that this potential has the property that its extrema correspond in one-to-one correspondence with where our regular instanton solutions match the enforced boundary conditions. Okay, so this idea of taking a slice through the alpha and beta curve and to choose the the bulk geometries that correspond to the boundary theory are exactly choosing the extrema of the effective potential for your deformation operator. Okay, clear? So now, given that we have this curve for both the free and the beta I, we have for both the free and the strongly coupled theory, we can just compute this quantum effective potential, and we do. And this is what it looks like. So in the free theory, as expected, for subcritical deformations, you have a stable vacuum, just given by the minimum of this effective potential. Then as you get to the critical deformation, this minimum disappears. And there's no stable vacuum for tachyonic scalation de Sitter, where this deformation is larger than the critical value. Then it gets slightly more complicated in the strong coupling case because our beta alpha curve is slightly more interesting. But again, for subcritical deformations, for small negative beta, you still have a stable theory with a single minimum. But then at the critical deformation, we suddenly have two instantons that correspond to a given fixed beta, which means that a maximum in this effective potential appears. So in the region between the critical beta and the minimal beta in the strongly coupled theory, we only have a metastable vacuum corresponding to the first smaller finite geometry. And then the second saddle point with a larger finite that enters corresponds to an unstable maximum in the theory. Okay? So we lose the overall stability, but there's still metastability in this region where you have two instantons centering. And then for large deformation below the minimum beta, you have no stable vacuum again. Okay. So sort of the message that I want to convey here is just that by comparing these two things, I'm giving the first hint that this instability, which is going to be a signature of the singularity, is connected to the massless minimally coupled scalar field in De Sitter. And from this potential, this is just shown by the fact that the instability in the potential sets in at this critical deformation beta, which in the free theory is connected to the massless minimally coupled case. Okay. So this is all that I want to say about the effective potential. And so I will move on to discussing the geodesic approximation as a method for calculating two-point functions on the boundary. Okay. So, what the geodesic approximation tells us is that in whatever our boundary state is, which I denote by psi, we can compute the two-point function for a heavy operator, O delta, where delta is much larger than one, through a path integral approximation, summing over saddle points, which are given by the length of the regularized length of a geodesic connecting the two points on the boundary at which the operators are inserted. Okay. This has been used, I think, mostly, and at least as far as I know, initially. Initially, it was used by Balasubramanian and Ross to study black holes in ADS, and then again by these authors, some of the early work. And the in their case, this sum over different saddle points was summing over different geodesics in these backgrounds that connect the same, in these black hole backgrounds that connect the same two boundary points. Okay. However, for us, because we have the full de Sitter symmetry on the boundary, there's only a unique length for a geodesic that connects two boundary points. But for us, this sum will be over the different geometries that enter into the path integral. Okay. Okay. So now we have to calculate all the ingredients. So we calculate all the geodesics in these crunching ADS cosmologies. And this has been done before, so a lot of these are sort of well-known results right now. But they're, one important point is that there's a shadow region. So geodesics anchored on the boundary do not go beyond a certain hypersurface in the FRW cosmology. So as I showed you, the scale factor in the FRW cosmology increases to some maximum value, which I identify as happening at the surface of constant T max. And no geodesic that has endpoints on the boundary will probe at a time greater than T max. So you can only get so close to the singularity in FRW time. And this has been used and argued, or it's been assumed that this means that because these geodesics aren't getting close to the singularity in some sense, that these boundary correlators don't have information about the singularity. Okay, so we don't find this to be the case, and I'll make that clear. Yeah, and again, just because we have the de Sitter invariance on the boundary, there's a unique length of a geodesic that separates any two points. And it can only depend on the de Sitter invariant distance between the two points. So this makes calculating these geodesics a lot simpler, as long as you cover, you know, you don't have to calculate the most generic geodesics. You just have to cover all boundary separations. Okay? So we calculate these lengths numerically in most cases, or to the full expression, we can only calculate numerically. However, in certain limits, we can calculate these lengths analytically. So specifically in the limit of small boundary separation, as you take the two boundary points very close to each other, the geodesic only probes the very near boundary region of this asymptotically ADS space. And this is what the length looks like. So you have a universal volume type divergence term. This is just because the conformal boundary is technically infinitely far away. So you expect the length to be infinite. And then you also have a universal logarithmically diverging term. And then subleading terms that depend on the asymptotic behavior of the scalar field. Okay. So to regularize the length, we just want to subtract the universal volume divergence, which just amounts to subtracting this first term. And since we're in the near boundary expansion, it's only the leading behavior of the scale factor as you go to the boundary that counts. Okay. So here A1 is just the coefficient or the leading coefficient of the near boundary expansion. And so this regularization procedure just amounts to subtracting these two terms. The second universal term is just the expected universal light cone singularity as you take two coincident points. Okay. So the other limit in which we can compute things analytically is in the IR, which is going to be sort of the focus for the rest of this talk as we look at the IR effect on the correlator from the singularity. And there we find we have a logarithmic divergence with the de Sitter invariant distance, and with a coefficient given by the maximum value of a scale of the scale factor in a given geometry. Okay. So here I've just plotted this regularized length as a function of z, or here, if you like, in terms of the, maybe more intuitively, is the in terms of the de Sitter invariant distance. Okay. And another point is that here, this the black curve is just for some instanton geometry with a small deformation. But the blue and the red are from two different instanton geometries that correspond to the same boundary deformation. So for a fixed boundary condition that's below this critical beta, both of these geometries, and therefore both of these lengths, would have to be summed in the geodesic approximation to calculate the correlator. Okay. So clearly, as maybe I mentioned or forgot to mention before, when you're summing these multiple saddle points, they have to be weighted. And maybe unsurprisingly, for a path integral calculation, the saddle points are weighted with the value of the Euclidean action. Okay. So for each of these geometries, we have to compute the Euclidean action. To get something finite, we perform holographic renormalization. But this is a standard procedure. So we have the value of the Euclidean action, which I've plotted here. And here I mark with the same markers correspond to geometries that enter at the same value of beta. Okay. So we see, so here, when the second saddle point enters that has a large phi naught, it enters with a smaller negative value, so a larger value of the Euclidean action. And so its weighting in the sum over saddle points is subdominant. Okay? And I'm just mentioning that this is also reminiscent of the story of eternal black holes in ADS. Okay? So now we have all the ingredients to actually compute this boundary correlation function for a heavy boundary operator. Okay? And here is what it looks like. You have a you sort of have a continuum until you get to this critical beta. When you get to the critical beta and start adding the second saddle point, you suddenly develop this IR tail. Okay, so this correlation function doesn't die off as you would expect. Okay? So we're particularly interested in when you get to this critical deformation, and so this seems to manifest in this IR tail, so we'll specifically look at the IR limit. So plugging in what we found for the length in the IR limit, just that top formula, plugging this into the geodesic approximation, we get this dependence on the geometrical data. So it's this A1 enters, which we that's entering because of the subtraction scheme for the regularized length. And then the other geometrical data that's relevant in the IR is the maximum value of the scale factor in the FRW cosmology. Okay. So good. So this is just same formula written again. And I want to note, or I want to say that the this IR behavior, this strong kind of constant behavior in the IR, is coming exactly from the second saddle point that that enters with a large value of phi naught. Okay? So you can see that as you increase phi naught, the maximum of this scale factor is going to zero. This is something we were able to prove, but you can just see it by eye. It seems intuitive there. And so that in the sum over saddle points, even though the weighting is subdominant, the IR is completely dominated by this by the saddle point that has the smaller value of A max. Okay? Furthermore, as you take the value of phi naught higher and higher, another thing that we were able to prove, but again, you can just see it by looking at the plots, is that the proper distance, the proper time distance between the maximum value of the scale factor and the crunch is shrinking. So here, this separation is much smaller than this one. Okay, and it's going to zero as you take the limit of the singular instanton. Okay, so in the deep IR, where the geodesic is lying almost entirely along the surface of t equals t max, the proper time between that surface and the surface of the singularity is going to zero. Okay, so in that sense, this strong IR tail is really coming from geodesics that do probe close to the singularity. Okay. So in this sense, this is my claim that the IR tail is a signature of the singularity. Okay. Okay. So I just want to end, which it seems I'm going faster than expected, with a comparison of these two-point functions in the strong coupling regime that I calculate with the geodesic approximation, and in the free theory, which I can just calculate analytically. Okay. So the geodesic approximation will only calculate the two-point function for a heavy operator on the boundary. So in the free theory, we can make a composite heavy operator just by taking the scalar field, raising it to some power. Then the two-point function of this operator can just be, you can just do this by Wick contraction, and you just find the two-point function raised to the nth power, okay? So I'm focusing on this limit now just because it's something that we can actually find some analytic results. So I'll expand in the IR and also in the regime of small beta, okay? So in the near ADS, so for small phi naught, this corresponds to a very small deformation of the boundary theory or a very small mass deformation for the scalar. So in this IR limit of the conformally coupled massless scalar, the free theory two-point function looks like this. Okay. So this leading term is just the conformally coupled case that's just encompasses the short distance singularity. And then corrections coming from the mass deformation. Okay. In the strong coupling, we can solve for the geometric data asymptotically, order by order, in phi naught or equivalently in beta. So we can find these expansions for the relevant geometrical data. Just plug this into the geodesic approximation, and we find this behavior for the two-point function at strong coupling. Okay. So the thing that I would like to note, I'm comparing weak and strong coupling. I have no real justification to say why these things should have anything to do with each other. But in these limits, the functional dependence on the boundary separation is identical. I have the leading, the sort of conformal, the term just that is coming from the conformal case, and then identical z dependence on the corrections. However, these corrections enter at a different order in beta. Okay, so we already know that the critical deformation value of beta is different in weak and strong coupling. This shouldn't be surprising because we expect these constants to flow as we dial the coupling. But we do find that the dependence on the boundary separation is identical. Okay. But this isn't really the case that we're interested in. We're interested in this case of critical deformation. So in the free theory, this just corresponds to taking the IR limit, so I'm expanding in z going to infinity and also in beta going to beta critical to give the minimally coupled massless scalar. And this is what the expansion looks like. I have an overall diverging constant with respect to the boundary separation. And this is just the pathological zero mode that needs to be subtracted to have a well-defined massless minimally coupled scalar. And then I have this heavy log tail that you find in the IR in the massless minimally coupled limit, okay? In the strongly coupled case, in this limit of singular instantons that enter at beta going to beta critical, I don't have analytic control. I can't solve for this geometrical data analytically. However, we fit these things numerically. We find this dependence on beta and beta critical, where this A, B1, and B2 are positive order one constants. Okay. So we take this this kind of numerical data, plug it in to the geodesic approximation, and find this dependence for the two-point function in the limit of critical deformation in the IR. And again, you see an overall diverging constant, which looks like the zero mode in the massless minimally coupled case. And you see the heavy log tail for the z dependence. So again, the dependence on the boundary separation is identical in both cases. However, here, the beta dependence is completely different. And in this expansion, you find what looks like an instanton expansion. Okay, so this is something that I don't I don't have a deep understanding of this by any means, but this is something that I'm interested in continuing to look at. And this sort of hint, the fact that this looks like an instanton expansion, it's just e to the minus 1 over some coupling, is also sort of supported by the fact that in the effective potential that we computed, as beta goes to beta critical, you have a metastable minimum in the vacuum of the theory. Okay, so I don't have any more answers there. This is more sort of a hint to me than a result. But yeah. Okay. So that's all I wanted to say. Sort of the recap is that these bulk cosmological singularities seem to correspond to the massless minimally coupled limit in the free theory of a scalar and a sitter space. Okay. We see this in the effective potential in that it's both at a critical deformation that you find the onset of instability in this theory. We see this in sort of one of the hallmarks of the massless minimally coupled limit, that you have this heavy IR tail in the two-point function. We find this in the strong coupling case, and it's coming exactly from geodesics that can come arbitrarily close to the singularity. And we see that even comparing weak and strong coupling, that the dependence on the boundary separation of these correlators is identical. Okay. These results, I think, are interesting, and it's worth going further. The first two points are, I think, closely connected, and it's what I just mentioned, the fact that you have this, it looks like an instanton expansion in the strong coupling limit, is connected to the effect of potential having a metastable minimum. But it's conjectured that a quantum effective potential should be convex in the ground state, whereas ours is clearly not, because we have this maximum and then an unstable minimum. So it's possible that something about our assuming these regular instanton geometries has somehow excluded maybe the true ground state of this theory, that you could have some more complicated scalar profile that would lead to an actual lower energy state with a convex effective potential. And then also topic of ongoing investigation is to try to go beyond the geodesic approximation. So the geodesic approximation is very nice. It allows us to calculate these boundary correlators using only bulk geometric data. However, it has limitations. It's not as direct as you might like it to be. And so we're trying to go further with this by calculating correlation functions directly in these bulk geometries, such as looking at the fluctuations in the scalar field. Okay, well, that's it. Thank you. Yeah?
Sorry, I'm just a bit confused. Your instantons all look singular, so.
How so?
Well, the geometry that you sketched right at the beginning had a singularity, right?
Right.
So they all look singular. So what do you mean by?
Okay, sorry, wrong direction. So the instantons are the solutions defined in the Euclidean, right? So it's the instanton solution is a scalar field solution to the Euclidean equations of motion. So defined on this three-sphere with some radial profile determined by this, they're defined here, okay? So, and actually those instanton profiles are exactly the same as the scalar field profile in the exterior of the light cone, okay? The fact that after Lorentzian continuation, you have a cosmological evolution that leads to a singularity is a general feature of any instanton that tunnels into ADS. So anytime you have tunneling into ADS, you end in a crunch, okay? So by singular, so I'm not talking about that that singularity, the cosmological singularity is the one that I'm interested in studying in the end. Mm-hmm. When I'm talking about the singular limit, when I say singular instantons, I mean really singular in the Euclidean, okay? Not talking about cosmological evolution. And so that singularity, I mean phi not going to infinity. So as I set the boundary conditions beta equal to beta critical, a corresponding instanton has a divergent value of phi naught at the origin in the Euclidean. So that's what I mean when I say singular
and then
instanton.
And when you go beyond that beta critical, it's still just singular
Well,
the origin, or?
No. No. So
has to become regular the origin.
Right. So here, so beyond the beta critical for a beta between the critical value and the minimum there, I have regular instantons with finite value of phi naught, right? They correspond to drawing a line and hitting two points on this curve, right? So for some beta less than beta critical, I have a point here. This is a perfectly regular instanton. It's only at the beta critical that I have this truly singular one. Also, furthermore, this limit kind of only exists from below, right? Obviously, if I'm approaching from this, there's some sort of, I mean, the limit doesn't exist from above. So the singular instanton is, when I say that, I really only mean at the critical deformation. You have an instanton entering where this is, this phi naught for the corresponding geometry is asymptoting to, is going to infinity. Okay. Yeah?
So you're using the De Sitter slide, De Sitter coordinate on the boundary to study this, which is convenient because the time never evolved beyond the singularity. But I can use your instanton as, I can treat it as setting the initial condition of the ADS at some time slice and evolve it forward. I will run into this cosmological singularity. I can do that using the usual last slice time, which will go beyond the singularity. So can we know what will happen on the boundary theory in that case?
So I would say that I think the theory that you're talking about, where you use a flat slicing on the boundary, is connected to the theory that I'm talking about on the De Sitter slice through a conformal transformation. Right? I can do.
But up to some time. Right? Because the t equal to infinity in your De Sitter slicing is only some finite time in the flat slicing boundary.
Right.
So do you expect the flat slicing theory on the boundary to also run into kind of a field theory singularity and have to stop there?
Yeah, and so this was studied previously. Some of that previous work that I listed on like the second slide did exactly that. I think the way I view this is this slicing is a sort of a development moving further because we can get away from a singular boundary theory. But people study this flat slicing with exactly this type of bulk geometry initially, and what you find is that there, this on the flat slicing, the field theory has a time-dependent coupling that diverges at finite time. So you find that some coupling constant in the theory diverges at exactly where that singularity would hit if you did the transformation. People have studied that, but then you're clearly studying a sick theory if that happens. Okay. People have looked at that.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to recast these ideas to study Big Bang singularities?
So I would say that, I mean, once we take this Euclidean data, once we do the Lorentzian continuation, this is a time symmetric problem. So, you know, if I remove this, I get to just reflect this, and I have a Big Bang that is. So I think that in that sense, anything we learn about this crunch could be then extrapolated to say about the Bang. Once you do the Lorentzian continuation, this is a time symmetric problem. I didn't talk about that because I think it's kind of nicer to start with this Euclidean, regular Euclidean starting point. And also, obviously, going through this, there's also like a bounce singularity here if I do that. And obviously, that's very interesting in its own right. I think in this setup, anything that you can say about this crunch can be just time reverse to say about the Bang.
Is there any questions? All right, so let's have that later.